Rabbi Horowitz got in two jokes. He stole my first one, and he called me a gadol b'Torah. That's even a bigger joke than the first one. But I'll tell you the truth, that I probably do deserve the title. I'll tell you why. The Mediterranean Sea is called the Yam HaGadol. Now, if you look at a map, you'll see very clearly that the Mediterranean Sea is a drop in a bucket compared to the Atlantic and the Pacific. So why is it called the Yam HaGadol? So the Gemara says because a portion of it washes up on the shore of Eretz Yisrael. And that makes it Gadol. So I also washed up on the shore of Eretz Yisrael about 27 years ago, so I guess that gives me the title also. We have gone through Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Asher Yisimei Tshuva, Shabbos Tshuva, Yom Kippur, and now we are ready for the finale, Sukkos. And the question is raised, why do we celebrate Sukkos now? Really, chronologically, Pesach celebrates our exodus from Egypt. Shavuos, 49 days later, we received the Torah. And then we went on our trek in the desert and dwelt in Sukkos. And God surrounded us with the clouds of glory. So why didn't Sukkos follow Shavuos? Why do we wait so long to celebrate Sukkos? What does it have to do with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? That's the question that is asked by many, and there are many answers given. And I'm going to tell you what I think. I see that they've sold some of these books here, so I got to admit, some of what I'm going to tell you, not everything, but some of it is plagiarized from that book. So if you see the same thing I'm saying in the book, you'll know where I got it from. Or where he got it from, one of the two. Okay. The Torah says that there are three components to mitzvahs. Beficha, your mouth, bilvavcha, your heart, lasoso, and action. Speech, thought, action. And most mitzvahs have all three parts. You make a bracha with speech, you have to have kavana, you have to have intention, and you do it, actually. Now, if you think about it, the order doesn't seem to make any sense. If I were to ask you to put speech, thought, and action into a logical order, I would say there's two possibilities. Either I would start with thought, which is the most spiritual, then go to speech, which is less spiritual, but not physical, and then action, or the opposite. Action, speech, thought. Why does the Torah put it in the order of speech, thought, and then action? So I think the reason is that there are two kinds of thoughts. And even though the first kind of thought precedes speech, it's not really a real concrete kind of thought. Let me explain what I mean. I'm sure that all of you have, as I have, at some point read a comic book. In the comic books, when somebody gets a revelation, a thought that, you know, really is an inspiring thought, there's a little light bulb that lights up, right? That light bulb is the first kind of thought, but it's not in words. It's not clearly defined. It's not crystallized. It's just an idea. In order to be able to make that idea concrete and to give it parameters and crystallize it and define it, you have to speak it out. When you speak it out, that's when the thought becomes a really concrete thought. And therefore, the first level is not that nebulous kind of thought. That's not counted. It's after you verbalize it, you speak it out, then you concretize that thought. And then you can act upon it. So that's really the order of how people function. They have this nebulous revelation, hashra'ah, as they call it in Hebrew, and then they verbalize it and put it into a formal kind of thought, and then they act upon it. This echoes another threesome that really is parallel to this idea of speech and then thought and then action. And that is Chochma, Bina, Das. Chochma is basically information. And information you get by verbalizing things, by enunciating facts. That's Chochma. Then there's Bina. Bina is in the heart. Bina is understanding the implication of those facts. Understanding what they're all about. The deeper understanding, just knowing the facts doesn't necessarily mean that you know what to do with them. Or you know what they really mean. So after you have the facts, you think about them, you mull over them internally, thought-wise, and understand what their implications are, what their true parameters are. And then once you have the Chachma and the Bina, you can act. That's called Das. Das, the word Das, has a connotation of a connection. You connect in from the world of speech and thought, which are very ethereal, to the real concrete world of this world. And you take those ideas and you put them into practice. That's called Das. Das is synthesizing the ideas you have, lemaisa, action, putting it into the physical world. Now, if you think about it, those are the three Yamim Tovim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. Pesach is speech. Pesach, in fact, the word Pesach, they say, hints to that. Pesach, a mouth that speaks. Okay, Pesach, and the protagonist, negative protagonist on Pesach was Paro, is Pera, bad mouth. And what did we do at the Seder? Basically, at the Seder, we use our mouths. That's it. Either you're eating or you're talking. That is the Seder. And the Seder, who is the main son at the Seder? The Chacham. So it's Chachma. At the Seder, we basically enunciate, we talk. The more we talk, the better it is. At the Seder, we talk about the foundations of what our wisdom, Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem. Wisdom is based on knowledge of God, fear of God. That's wisdom. So we speak about the exodus from Egypt, the fact that there's a God, the fact that God controls the world and is involved in the world. That is the Chochma, that is the database of Judaism. Facts. Facts. That's Pesach. And we use our mouth, Chochma with the mouth. That is Pesach. Come Shavuos, and there are no mitzvahs to do, and there's nothing to say. Shavuos represents the acceptance of the Torah. That's in your heart. Kabbalah Balei, Bina. Once on Pesach, I know that there's God, and I know He's involved with me, and He's involved with the world. So what do I do with that? So at Shavuos, I understand the implications. If I really believe that God created the world, if I really believe that He cares what happens in this world, then I have to find out what His plan is and follow it. So that's the Bina. That is the next stage, the understanding of the knowledge that I got on Pesach with my mouth to put it into my heart and accept what, so what? So what am I supposed to do? And accept the Torah. So the Bina that comes from the Chochma is celebrated on Shavuos. It's a thought process. It's something in the heart. There are no mitzvahs on Shavuos to say, not from the Torah, and there's nothing to do. We just celebrate the Yontif, and in our heart, we re-accept the Torah. That is Shavuos. And therefore, accepting the Torah, understanding the implications. If I believe in all of this, so it has to bring me to an acceptance, to a commitment. That's called Bina. How do I know that Bina is a function or the acceptance of the Torah, the ability to make that connection? If I believe in all of this, then it naturally follows that I should want to know God's plan and accept God's plan, if I believe that God has a plan, that he created the world. How do I know that Bina is connected to being able to accept the Torah? I'll tell you why. Because the Gemara says that a girl becomes bas mitzvah a year earlier than her male counterpart. Boys have to wait till 13. Girls are already ready at 12 to accept mitzvahs. Why? Why are girls more prepared to accept mitzvahs than boys? Because bina yaseira nitna ba'isha, a woman was given extra bina, seems to imply that the power of bina, of understanding, of being able to see the implications of things, is that which makes it possible for a person to accept the Torah. And therefore, on Shavuos, we have that bina. We go from the Chachma of Pesach to the bina of Shavuos. We accept the Torah in our heart. That is in your heart. That is Shavuos. What follows? Once you have the data, you have the information, and you know how to use it, now put it into practice. Now put it into the real world. That's Sukkos. Sukkos is, we have a sukkah, an esrog, and lulav, and a host of sacrifices, and everything we now take from the realm of thought and speech and put it into action. Sukkah is the yontif of das. Laman yedu doroseichem ki basukos hoshafti es b'nei Yisrael. You should know and understand. You now understand the facts. You know what the implications are. Now put it into practice. That's Sukkah. So, Pesach comes first, then comes Shavuos, followed by Sukkos. There's only one problem. Unless you have those first two stages, unless you have the Chochmah and build on it the Bina, you can't come to Das. You can't make that connection. So, something happened that blemished the Chochmah that we got on Pesach when we were taken out of Egypt and got the facts that there's a God, and that he's involved in the world. And then on the Bina that we had on Shavuos, where we understood the implication of those facts and accepted God's Torah, then what happened? The sin of the golden calf. That blemished the wisdom that we got on Pesach, and it blemished the Bina we got on Shavuos. And it pretty much abrogated them. Didn't destroy them completely, but it surely mitigated them. So now we had to repent. But we needed something to be mashlin, to make up for what we lost of the effect of Pesach and the effect of Shavuos. What was that makeup, that hashlama, something that took the place of what we lost on Pesach? Two new holidays. Two new holidays. One that added what was lost at Pesach, and one that was added what was lost on Shavuos. The first holiday was called Rosh Hashanah. Now, even though it's very possible that these holidays would have existed even if there had been no sin of the golden calf, it's hard to second-guess God and to second-guess history. What would have been had things been different? We know the way they were. Okay. It could be that had things been different, these holidays would have existed. But I will bring you a proof that these holidays do have something to do with the atonement of the sin of the golden calf. Yom Kippur is obvious. Yom Kippur was chosen as the day of atonement, partially, because it's the day we were forgiven for the sin of the golden calf. It's the day we re-received the Torah. We received the Torah on Shavuos, but the luchos were broken. We never got it. When did we actually get it? On Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur clearly is a holiday that has to do with the atonement of the golden calf. Had there not been a sin of the golden calf, Yom Kippur would have been in a different perspective. One of the perspectives is surely that. The Gemara says that. That the yomtif of Yom Kippur, the fact that it's such a good day, right, such an eternal day, is because it's the day that we get Slicho Mechil, it's a day that we were forgiven for the sin of the golden calf, and the day we received the Torah. Now, what does Rosh Hashanah have to do with that? Rosh Hashanah, usually we understand, is the day that corresponds to the creation of the world, or more specifically, the creation of man. The world was created 6 days earlier on the 25th day of Elul, and man was created on the first day of Tishrei. That was the creation of man. But not everybody holds like that. There's an argument between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua in Rosh Hashanah, when the world was created. Rabbi Elazar says, Taka, the world was created in Tishrei. That means that man was created on the first day of Tishrei, so when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah, we're celebrating the day of the creation of man. But Rabbi Yeshua says that the world was created in Nisan. Really, the world was created on the 25th day of Adar, and man was created on the first day of Nisan. So the Rabbeinu Nisim asks, if that's the case, then what do we celebrate Rosh Hashanah? Then what is Rosh Hashanah? Nothing happened on the first day of Tishrei. Says the Rabbeinu Nisim, since the atonement for the sin of the golden calf was achieved on Yom Kippur, when we actually re-received the Torah, it didn't just happen overnight. It was a process. Now the truth is the process started 40 days earlier on the beginning of Elul. But the intensity of that process, says the Rabbeinu Nisim, reached its crescendo from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. Those 10 days, those last 10 days of the process, were the days that actually created the atonement for the sin of the golden calves. According to that, Rosh Hashanah also has something to do with the atonement of the sin of the golden calf. Because of the sin of the golden calf, the chokhmah, the wisdom that we got on Pesach, was to a certain degree abrogated. The bina that we had on Shavuos was abrogated, so we needed two Yomim Tovim to replace them. So we have Rosh Hashanah. Let's see what Rosh Hashanah is like. Rosh Hashanah, what do we use as the main tool? Rosh Hashanah, our mouth. We say extra long Shmon Esrei, Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros, and we blow the shofar. So Rosh Hashanah is very similar to Pesach. Pesach, we're blowing our horn at the Seder, right? And we are speaking extra. And Rosh Hashanah, we do the same thing. Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara says that the blowing of the shofar is called a chachma. Same chacham by the Seder, here is chachma by Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah, and what is Rosh Hashanah? We declare that God is the King. We believe in the fact that God exists. We speak about Zichronos, that God judges the world, that he's involved with the world. And Shofros, that there is a relationship between us and God. We speak to him from the narrow part, he listens from the open part. There's a relationship between us. So, Rosh Hashanah basically supplements and complements what we lost on Pesach. In a little bit different way, but the same idea. Mostly to do with the mouth and chachma. Ficha, your mouth, chachma, was lost to a certain degree on Pesach. We supplement it on Rosh Hashanah. What's Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is a double of Shavuos. Shavuos received the first tablets. They were broken. When did we receive the second tablets? The giving of the Torah a second time on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, the main thing is in your heart. Repent. Regret. Commit yourself to the future. And even though you have to speak out the vidui, the main thing is what's in your heart. So, Yom Kippur supplements Shavuos, and Rosh Hashanah supplemented Pesach, and once what we lost from the Chachma and the Bina is supplemented, now you can have Sukkos, because you can't have Sukkos unless you have Chachma and Bina. Unless you have the Beficha or Bilvavcha, you can't have the Lasosa. Unless you have what's in your mouth and in your mind, you can't have the action. So Sukkos had to wait. Sukkos had to wait until we were able to correct what we lost of Pesach with Rosh Hashanah and what we lost on Shavuos with Yom Kippur, and now Yom Kippur's over, now we have time for Sukkos. Take it one step further. In the davening of Sholosh Regalim, we say the following. It's also Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but right now we're talking about there's mainly three Yomim Tovim. It's just that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are supplements to two of them. So, the main Yomim Tovim is Pesach, with its supplement Rosh Hashanah, Shavuos with its supplement of Yom Kippur, and Sukkos. We say in Shmoneh Esrei, Ata v'chartonu mikol ha'amim. You have chosen us from all nations of the world. Ohavta osanu. You loved us. V'ratzisa banu. we'll translate it the way I think the Art Scroll or whatever translates it, which we'll see is not the way that it should be. And you desired us. And then we go on. V'romam tonu mikol ha'lashonos. You exalted us from all the tongues. V'kidashtonu b'mitzvosecha. You sanctified us with your commandments. V'keraftonu malkeinu l'avodasecha. And you brought us close to your service. Now let me tell you what it really means. These three, six things are really two groups of three that correspond to each other. Start with the first one. Ata v'chartonu mikol ha'amim. God chose us from all the nations of the world. That is that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us v'romamtonu mikol ha'lashonos. He made us exalted over all the other languages. What language do we speak? Our native language is Lashon HaKodesh, Hebrew. Lashon HaKodesh, which is the holy tongue. Language, Lashon, I think has a connection to the word Lash. Lash means to knead. Dough. Take flour and water, and you mix them together, you make a compound. That's Lisha. It's one of the 39 activities that are prohibited on Shabbos. Making a compound from something solid and something liquid and kneading it into a compound. Lisha means taking something spiritual and something physical and mixing them together. That's what the tongue does. The tongue takes the deepest thought and clothes it in sound waves and mixes it together and makes it something that you can hear in this physical world. It makes speech from thought. That's Lisha. That's meeting. That's Lush. And therefore, since what a person says, his language, is an expression of his deepest thoughts, language depends on a person's neshama. Every nation has its language that to a certain degree was developed after the Tower of Babel. And every nation, its language represents its neshama, its soul. Every nation has a different soul. Different soul. The soul of the Frenchman is not the same thing as the soul of an Eskimo. In Eskimo language, there are maybe 10 different words for snow. In French, there are probably 10 different words for love. So the neshama of the Frenchman is different than the neshama of the Eskimo. And the language represents it. And so every nation has a language that represents its essence. We have a language that represents our essence. It's called Lashon HaKodesh, holy tongue, because we in our essence are holy, which is something the other nations of the world don't have. They don't have that holiness. We are a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. We are a nation of priests. We represent God to the world. And we do it by living a holy existence. So, ato v'chartano, you chose us. How did you choose us? You made us special. You gave us a neshama. You gave us a soul that's holy. We have the potential to be holy people. That is the foundation of our existence, and it is represented by our tongue, by our speech. So that's Pesach. Ato v'chartano, you chose us. When did God choose us and separate us from the other nation? When he took us out of Egypt. And how did he do it? By giving us a neshama that's holy. And the neshama is expressed in speech. So we're back to the first level. Speech, Pesach, the basics of who we are. We believe in God. We believe that God believes in us. Next. Ohavta osanu. Okay, God chose us and he gave us a mission, but he also loves us. It's not just that he gave us a mission, that's it. Ahava has the same numerical value as echad, one. Ahava means a oneness, a commonality. When you feel one with something, when you feel you have a commonality, an affinity to something, that's love. Love is based on feeling a connection, a commonality to something. God wanted that he chose us shouldn't just be at a vacuum, but we should have a connection to him. We should be close to him. So therefore, what did he do? Kidashtonu b'mitzvosecha. He made us holy with his mitzvos. He gave us mitzvahs to make ourselves holy, to bring out that holiness. When we do a mitzvah, we are enveloped with holiness. So therefore, God said, I'm going to give you a potentially holy neshama, and I'm going to give you a way to bring out that holiness through doing mitzvahs. And when you bring out the holiness, you become like me. I'm holy, and you're holy. And therefore, ahavto sanu, we have a bond. There's a bond that connects us because we're the same. You can be like me. And that is the next stage where God gave us mitzvahs that we can do, and we can become like him, we can become holy, and when we're like him, there's a bond between us. That's shavuos. Shavuos, we got the Torah. Got mitzvahs. We got that tool to bring out that holiness that God gave us potentially when he separated us from the Egyptians and from the rest of the world. Finally, the ratzis abon. I said that the normal translation is, and you desired us. But that can't be that. Because if that's what it means, it should have said, ahavta osanu, you loved us, v'ratzisa osanu, and you desired us. Same language. Ahavta osanu, ratzisa osanu. What's ratzisa banu? Ratzisa banu means the following. You desire through us. God's desires in this world come through the Jewish people. What God does in the world depends on us. Yeah? We actually got the Torah on Shavuos. It was abrogated. Right. It was abrogated. Right. But it wasn't nullified completely.
Okay,
we received it on Yom Kippur. Yeah.
Okay. So really the fact is we got it on Yom Kippur.
Right.
So why do we celebrate
Shavuos? So Rabbi Harz is going to invite me back before Shavuos. And I have an entire shiur on that. Really. Yeah, not kidding. So I have a date. Okay, and I will answer your question. You have to remind me, though. Okay? I can't do it al regalachas. It is an hour answer. But it's an excellent question. I don't think you realize how an excellent question. There's more to it, and it's an really excellent question. So then, v'ratzisa banu means, you, God, will through us. And that is what we say sometimes, Osim Ritzono Shel Makom. We make God's will. Now, if that sounds strange to you, it shouldn't. Because you say it all the time when davening. Yehi Ratzon Milfanecha. May it be your will. What does that mean? Who is initiating God's will? Us. Through our Torah and our mitzvahs, and specifically through our avoda. Avoda is davening, sacrifices. We initiate God's will in the world. We ask him, we tell him, and that's what he wants. He wants us. He gave us the power of holiness. He gave us the tools to bring out that holiness. And he runs the world according to what we initiate. That's the way God wants it to be. He wants us to initiate his will in the world. That is v'ratzisanu. How did he do that? He brought us close to his service by serving him, by davening, by bringing sacrifices. We initiate God's will in the world. God says, I want various things to happen in this world, but I want you to be the initiators. I want you to get the credit for it. So we initiate God's will in the world. And again, those are the three Yamim Tovim. Pesach, God chose us, separated us from the Egyptians, chose us, made us special. Shavuos, he gave us the tools to bring out that potential. He gave us the Torah. And on Sukkot, he gave us the ability to initiate his will. That is Avoda. On Sukkot, we bring sacrifices for the entire world. All 70 nations, 70 bulls we bring on Sukkot. We have a tremendous amount of sacrifices. And tremendous amount of prayers. All of it. And we pray for rain. Rain is the material that keeps the world going. Without rain, there's no life. We're the ones who initiate that. We're the ones that God says, you pray for the rain. I'll bring you your rains. Matar arzachem gishmechem. Your rains. You initiate it. You bring that to the world. That's Sukkot. Sukkot is putting it into the world. And we're the ones who are responsible to see to it that God's will becomes manifested in this world. Okay. There's a very interesting medrash. Take this now to the next stage. Now that you have the basis of what these three Yomim Tovim are and how they connect to Chochma, Bina, Das, Beficha, Bilvavcha, Lasoso, and the Atav v'Chartanu, let's take it one step further. It says that Ulekachtem Lochem Bayom Harishon. Take the lulav on the first day. Well, it's not the first day. It's the 15th day of the month. What's the first day? First day of what? Rishon. So the Medrash says, there's a hint over here. Rishon lecheshbon avonos. It is the first day that God begins to tally our sins. Now many understand that to be that it means that after Yom Kippur, one judgment is finished. And God doesn't start the new judgment till the first day of Sukkot. That seems to imply there's four free days in this world. Don't leave. That's not what it means. There are no free days in this world. Every day you're responsible or whatever. There are many ideas given why that's the first day that God starts to count our sins. Some say because we have no time to do sins. Because we're so busy putting up our sukkah and buying estrog and lulav and women cooking for yontif, there's just no time to sin. Now, I don't really understand that because I find plenty of time to sin in 4 days, right? Maybe I'm not as busy as I should be. But I find that a little difficult. So what I think it may mean, Rishon lecheshbon avonos can mean you can sin, but you can't really think about it. It can't be a real quality sin because you're too busy. Right, so quality sins you need time to think about it. So it's the first day that you can really make a cheshbon and make a quality, well thought out sin. Because until the first day of Sukkot, you're too busy to really do any kind of thoughtful quality sin. Okay, maybe there are other answers. What?
The first day of Sukkot.
Yeah, you have time to rest, and what's it called? Most people sleep late and whatever. So yeah, and Sukkot's already it's Yom Tov. That's not really what it means anyway. There are 4 or 5 different answers. You can look at my sefer, not this one. Maybe it's in this one too. It could be. But the one on the Parshios, Outlooks and Insights, for Parshios Hazinu over there, I think I give you about 4 or 5 different answers, including one of my own. But the one I want to tell you tonight is not that at all. Different idea, and it's in this book, Taka. The Vilna Gaon says that there are really 2 judgments that everybody has to go through. One is a din. You're going to have to give a din. A judgment. Did this wrong? Did that right? Did this wrong? And you'll be rewarded and punished accordingly. Okay? For instance, God's going to judge each and every one of us, and he's going to say, well, if you spoke Lashon Hara for an hour, so this and this is the punishment for speaking Lashon Hara for an hour. That's the din. What about the cheshbon? The cheshbon means the following. God's going to say, okay, you're going to get your punishment for speaking Lashon Hara for an hour. But you weren't put in this world just to be parath. It's not only that you spoke Lashon Hara, you could have for that hour been doing tremendously good things. And you didn't. So not only are you going to have to give an accounting for the sin, the negative, but why didn't you do something positive during that time? That's called a cheshbon. What positive is missing? Okay, you did something negative, but you could have been doing positive. So not only should you have not done the negative, you should have done something positive. So you're going to be held responsible for the positive you didn't do, not just for the negative you did. Based on that, I want to say like this. Up until Yom Kippur, based on what happened historically, the Jewish people were given the Torah on Shavuos, and we lost it right away on Shivasa B'Tamuz, 40 days later. The luchos were broken, and we spent all our time atoning for the bad that we did. But you know what could have been had we not sinned with the golden calf? We would have gotten the Torah. We would have started learning and doing mitzvahs and building a mishkan, building the tabernacle. We had to wait 120 days, or 80 days at least, from the time the luchos were broken, until we could get started doing something positive. for those 80 days we concentrated on making up and atoning for the negative we did. But there was something. There was another thing. There was a cheshbon. What about the positive? We were so engrossed in the negative and getting it atoned for, we forgot about what we're supposed to be doing. We were supposed to be just getting away the negative for 80 days. We should have been doing something positive for those 80 days. The first day of Sukkot is Rishon L'Cheshbon Avonos. Up until Sukkot, we were worried about the din, Yom HaDin of Rosh Hashanah and the Yom HaDin of Yom Kippur and Rachamim. Get away the negative. But now we have a chance to look back and say, you know what? All those times during the year we're doing all those negative things, we could have been doing positive things. So let's get involved in the world and start doing something positive. And that's exactly what Sukkot is. Sukkot is the Yontif of Das, where we take what we understand, what the implications are, all the information we have, and we put it into practice. Do something with it. And that's on Sukkot we started building the Mishkan. Because Moshe came down on Yom Kippur, the next day he gave us the mitzvah. Took 4 days that they collected the materials, and the next day was what? Sukkot. We started building the Mishkan. That was Rishon L'Cheshbon Avonos. Till now we were worried about the din, the judgment, the negative. Now we could appreciate the positive. Okay, the negative is not there, but what is the positive? Start doing something positive. So we surround ourselves with mitzvahs. In order to do that, the sukkah and the esrog and the lulav and the hadashim and aravos teach us how to really use this world in a very positive way. How to take everything in the world and direct it towards service for God, where from this physical, material, temporal world we can create eternity. This world creates the world to come. Because there is a question that always bothered me, and I think I have an answer. It should have bothered you too. Maybe it did. We say that in one perspective, the sukkah represents this world. And the fact that this world is only temporal, it's temporary, just like the sukkah. It's not a permanent place. Our real permanent place is in the next world, eternally. And this is just a temporal world. So if that's the case, you should really make your sukkah to look really drab. Because we want to say that this world is not really the important place. This world is not really what's it called, the main thing. This is only a means to reach an end. It's not the end in itself. What do? We decorate the sukkah. Sukkah is beautiful. Hidr mitzvah, right? And the Gemara speaks about all the sukkah decorations, and there's a mitzvah to decorate your sukkah. It's part of the mitzvah. Now, I don't know if sukkah is supposed to represent the temporal world, and this world is not the main thing or whatever. We should make it as drab as possible, similar to what the Chafetz Chaim once retorted to somebody. A rich American businessman came to Rotten. He went to see the Chafetz Chaim. He walked into his home, and he saw he didn't have any furniture. There was no sofa. There was no break front. There was a table and chairs and another room, a bed, and that was pretty much his furniture. So this businessman never saw a house like that before. So he blurted out. He couldn't control himself. Where's your furniture? Chafetz Chaim looked him in the eye, and he said, "Where's your furniture?" He said, "My furniture, I'm just traveling through. My furniture is back home." Chafetz Chaim says, "I'm also only traveling through. My furniture is also back home." Right? This is only a temporal way station. This is not the main place. My furniture, I'm putting spiritual furniture in the next world. In this world, I have what I need to be able to pass through. So, then why do we make the sukkah so beautiful? Why do we decorate? Why do we make it drab so every time we go in that sukkah we know, this is this world, forget about it? The answer is that it says in Pirkei Avos that there are two ways of looking at this world. On the one hand, Yofa Shoachas Shel Koras Ruach Ba'olam Haba Mikol Chayolam Haba Hazeh. 1 second of peripheral pleasure in the world to come is greater than all the sum total of all pleasure that anyone ever experienced in this world. That means this world is nothing. It pales compared to the next world. There's nothing. All the enjoyment of all the people who ever lived is nothing compared to 1 second of peripheral pleasure in the world to come. That makes this world very, very unimportant. And yet there's another mission in Pirkei Avos The Mishnah says, Yofa Shoachas, Shel Tshuva Maisim Tovim Ba'olam Hazeh, 1 second of repentance and good deeds in this world is greater than the whole next world. So which is it? Seems to be contradictory. One Mishnah seems to edify this world, and one Mishnah seems to edify the next world. So if we were academians or scholars, we'd probably say that there are two schools of thought amongst the rabbis. There's this worldly school and the other worldly school. Some rabbis like this world, some rabbis like the next world. There's only one problem. The same individual said both of these Mishnayos, and he wasn't schizophrenic, so he didn't argue with himself. So there must be some qualification as to when this world is superior to the next world, or when this world is nothing compared to the next world. The answer is, what your perspective on life is. I think we once spoke about this here in great detail. If your perspective on life is what it said on a t-shirt that I once saw them selling in New York, the one who has the most toys when he dies wins. Meaning that this world, you're born, you eventually die, and the purpose of life is to amass toys. Toys when you're little are little. Toys when you get bigger become big. Toys are anything that gives you pleasure. Experiences, things, right? Amass toys. That's your purpose in life. And if you amass the most toys, by the time you die, you win the game. Now, I was looking for an asterisk that would have a footnote that would say exactly what you won at that time since you were dead. And then I heard about a woman from L.A. who asked not to be buried in a casket, but rather to be buried in her Rolls Royce. She had the biggest toy. They buried her in it. She won. Now, I don't know exactly what it did for her to be buried in a Rolls Royce. I'm sure her gas mileage from that point on was great because she wasn't going anywhere. But she won. Now, if that is your perspective on life, then life in this world is meaningless. And many people realize that when they get to midlife. No matter how many toys they have, they realize that you can look at life in the following way if that's all your life is. It starts when you're born, ends when you die, fill it up with toys. Then you could describe a life like that in the following way. Imagine a man standing outside the delivery room waiting for news of his wife's impending birth. And the midwife or doctor, whichever you prefer, comes out and says, I had terrible news for you. Your wife just gave birth to a baby. The baby was born with a disease that is fatal and can't survive. He's going to die for sure from the disease he was born with. The man says to the doctor, Doctor, give me hope. There's a cure. No, there's no cure. You're looking for a cure. Nah, we gave up looking for a cure long ago. Somebody survived this terrible disease miraculously, never in the annals of medical history. Father said, I never heard of such a terrible disease. There's no cure. You're not looking for a cure. No one ever survived. What's the name of this terrible disease? He says, you see, when your child was born, he contracted the disease we call life. Some people survived 80 years, 90 years, 120. We don't know how long it's going to take. We know one thing for sure. Whoever was born with a disease called life eventually succumbs to it. Now, isn't that really what it is? Right? If you would know how many seconds we're going to live, and somebody sent me recently how many seconds there are in 120 years. Okay, you can figure it out yourself. Multiply 120 years by 365 days, by 24 hours, by 60 minutes, by 60 seconds. You get a big number. Put it on a digital display. And the moment you're born, press the button, and the numbers start going down towards zero. So basically, when you're born, you begin to die. I don't mean to depress you, because that's not our perspective of life. Our perspective of life is that life begins before you're born. It began for all of us as souls in the spiritual world, where we existed from the creation of the world, somewhere under God's throne, whatever that means. We were existed as souls. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting around inside of us. We are souls who, when we came into this physical world, needed a spacesuit to wear called a body. Just like an astronaut. As long as he's on the earth, he can function very nicely without any apparatus. Goes into outer space, he needs an oxygen apparatus. He needs a radio to talk through. There is no sound waves. He needs a pressurized suit. Comes back to Earth, takes it off. Same thing with us. We were created as souls in a spiritual world. We could talk and get around and think and see and hear without a body. A soul in a spiritual world can function very nicely. But then we were forced to come into this physical world. So we need a spacesuit. So God gave us a body, an inner spacesuit. Ears to hear and eyes to see and so on. We go back to the spiritual world, we leave the body here. Take off the space, the astronaut takes off the suit when he comes back to Earth. And it could be for that reason, how do we express mourning? We tear our clothing to show it's only the clothing that's been torn away. The essence of the person is the same. So our life doesn't start when we're born. It doesn't end when we leave this world. It's eternal. And what we do in this world creates that eternity. God said, I'm going to put you in a physical world, distance from me. You create the bond. You create the connection. And every single physical, material thing in this world can be used in some way, either by not using it because it's not in God's plan, or by using it properly, and in that way we create our eternity. So this world's a very important place as a means to reach an end. If you look at this world as a means to reach an end, it's even greater than the world to come. Because here you can create more and more eternity. There is no limit to eternity. It's infinite. In mathematics, there is an infinite amount of whole numbers. There's also an infinite amount of fractions between every whole number. That means there's an infinite amount of infinities. So in the world to come, there's an infinite amount of eternities. You can get more and more in every second. So if you look at this world as a means to reach an end, then this world is even greater than the world to come, because here you create it, and you create more, and once you're there, that's it. But if you look at this world as an end in itself, this is the place to enjoy. Get your toys, and that's it. Then this world is meaningless. It's a long death. You're born, you begin to die. That's all. It's a sickness that we contract when we're born that eventually we succumb to. So the sukkah gives me the understanding at night. Never bother you. I have other answers to this, but if I think of the question, maybe you'll find some other answers at your sukkah table. The main purpose of the schach is to make what? No? What's the purpose of the schach? What? Shade, right? You're supposed to put it up. The shade sale. For the sake of making shade. It doesn't keep the rain out. It doesn't keep the bugs out. Right? It only keeps the sun out. Shade. That is schach. Schach is shade. Okay. When is the main mitzvah of sukkah? The halacha is you must eat in the sukkah only at one time during those 7 days. The rest of the week, if you don't want to eat, or you don't want to eat things that you need the sukkah, you don't have to go in the sukkah. When is the mitzvah that you must eat in the sukkah? The first night. Anybody ever see the sun at night? What kind of shade? The main thing of the sukkah is shade. And the main part of the mitzvah is at night. But the idea is the sun represents this world. We read Koheles on Sukkot. Tachas HaShemesh, under the sun. We have a lunar year. The moon is always changing. When vis-a-vis the world to come, people are always changing, and they're doing, and they're creating, and they're destroying. When it comes to the solar year and this world, everything is just the same, goes by cycle or whatever. The sun doesn't change. The sun just makes revolutions. Life in this world, for this sake of this world, there's no changes. The changes are eternal changes when you think about the next world and you do spiritual things. So this world is represented under the sun. And we want to minimize that sun a little bit and make shade. But at when do we get the idea? At night, when we're preparing for how to look at this world in the daytime. First, get your perspective on this world. So the sukkah is a temporary place. This world is not the end. It's a means to reach an end. It's a temporary place where you create the world to come. And therefore, the sukkah is temporary. And it means that this world is not important as an end in itself. But if you use it properly, then it's the most beautiful place there can be. It's even more beautiful in the world to come. Because here you can create. So the sukkah on the outside may look drab. But when you're inside and you're using it properly and you understand what this world is all about, then this world is a beautiful place. So we make the sukkah beautiful. And once at night we get our perspective properly, then the next day we take the esrig and the lulav and the hadassim and the aravos, and we use everything in this world to create that eternal world. Everything somehow can be used in a way that creates eternity. How so? So first of all is the Esrog. The Esrog represents the heart, which is the essence of everything. It also represents Torah, and the person who is well-versed in Torah and knows how to live his life properly. Everything. He has the right ideas, he has the right conduct, toko, his tam, the taste and the smell go together. The Esrog is the ultimate. Now, some say that when Adam HaRishon was created, first man and woman, they had one mitzvah: don't eat from the tree of knowledge. But many commentaries say, especially the Kabbalists, that prohibition of not eating from the Eitz HaDaas was temporary. It was only on Friday. According to some, the tree of knowledge was a grapevine. It was not an apple. Okay? There are about 6 different opinions in the Gemara. None of them are an apple. Okay? So, we'll see 2 of them at least. One is a grapevine. According to that opinion, Adam HaRishon was supposed to not eat from that tree. He was created on Friday, 3 hours before Shabbos. He was supposed to wait 3 hours, take that grapes. His wife was supposed to make wine from the grapes, and he was supposed to make kiddush on the tree of knowledge. Now, in my limited understanding of that, let me tell you what I understand of that. My understanding is the following. That until Shabbos came and gave real spirituality to this physical world, it was hard for the first man and woman to take the physical world and use it for spiritual things. They needed the Shabbos to help them. But once Shabbos came, they could take, the tree of knowledge represented the bond, das, Eitz HaDaas, right? We said das means a bond. You bond with the physical world. But if you don't have the right perspective and you start bonding with the physical world, it's going to drag you down into pleasure for the sake of pleasure, not a means to reach an end of spirituality. So they needed that first Shabbos to give them the right perspective. And then they could use that tree of knowledge to elevate everything in this world and use it for the sake of the world to come, use it for the sake of serving God. And they ate 3 hours early. On Friday, without that, and they were dragged down into the physical world for its own sake. Toys. That perspective. And that's why they were punished. According to another opinion, the tree of knowledge was an esrog. According to that, it could be that they were supposed to wait 10 days to use that esrog. Or not 10 days, 15 days to use that esrog to have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then to have a sukkah and use that esrog the same way they would have made kiddush on it. Use it now. Use that fruit of knowledge to sanctify the entire world. Take that heart that the esrog represents, and with your heart, take everything and elevate it instead of it dragging you down. So that's what the esrog represents. And the other minim, the other 3 times, the hadassim, the myrtle, and the aravos, the willow, and the lulav, all represent how we take different parts of the world and elevate it to God. They represent different parts of our body. The lulav represents a spine. One way of elevating things in this world towards God is by engendering the right ideas, belief in God, fear of God, love of God. That is what makes us different than an animal. An animal looks down, all it sees is physical things. An animal, all it knows is the physical world. But man stands straight and looks and faces God. He looks up towards the spiritual. That's a spine. Gives him the ability to do that. And the spine represents the ability to be able to connect into God. How do you do that? Before you're able to know how to use the world, you have to have the right foundation. The foundation is belief and fear of God, love of God. That's represented by the lulav, which is also the leaf that protects the fruit. the fruit is actually taking this world and using it, elevating it. But you need a protection. The protection is belief, fear, love of God. Then there is the myrtle. The myrtle represents the eye. A good eye means you have good character traits. You're a good person. You develop good character traits between man and man, between man and yourself. And that's how you begin to use this world properly, by behaving properly in the world. And that's why the myrtle has three leaves on each level. Because good qualities, good midos, character traits, come in threes. There's the two extremes, right? A person who is stingy can be extremely stingy. A person who is, what's it called, very generous can be extremely generous. And usually, what's the best? Somewhere in between. Not to be too stingy or too generous, but to be the golden mean. When it comes to midos, there's always three parts, the two extremes and the middle. So that is the, and that has a good smell. It's good, basically, in how other people perceive you, but there's no real, you're not doing anything. You're just becoming somebody that has a nice aroma for other people. And then there's the aravos. The aravos have no taste, and they have no smell. They are intrinsically worthless, but they represent the mouth. If you designate them for something good, you can take an ice cream cone. An ice cream cone has no intrinsic holiness. Okay, it's not one of the tarig mitzvahs to eat ice cream, not to eat ice cream if it's kosher. Okay, there's no mitzvah to eat an ice cream cone. There's no prohibition not to eat it. So the ice cream cone is like the arava. It has no taste, and it has no substance. What does it have? It represents the mouth. If I designate, I need that ice cream cone to make me feel better. And when I eat the ice cream cone and I feel good about myself, then I am a good person. I go home and I speak nicely to my spouse, and I'm good to my children, and I'm good to my neighbors, and I feel like doing mitzvahs. So that ice cream cone, I've taken and used it as a means that's something good. How do I do it? By designating it verbally. This is what I'm using it for. So there are many things in this world that are not intrinsically valuable. Not like the esrog, which is Torah, or the lulav, that is, what's it called? Yirashamayim and Avas Hashem. Those are intrinsically good things. Or good character traits. So much in this world is parath. You could use it for good, you could use it for negative, you could use it parath. It depends how you designate it. How do you designate things? Basically, by saying, I'm using this for this and this purpose. So that's the majority of the world, is the arava. That is how we designate this world for God. And therefore, at night, we go into the sukkah, we understand this world is not an end, it's a means. If that's the case, then take everything in the world, all the different types, and use them, your character, your wisdom, your emotions, and all the physical things in the world. And there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, I think, that represents this. The Mishnah says, Yehi mamon chavercha chaviv alecha kishaloch. Let somebody else's money be as precious to you as your own. They have a shokud luma Torah, and you should be diligent in learning Torah, because you won't inherit it. It comes only through diligence. And everything you do will be for the sake of heaven. Two questions here. What in the world does these three things have to do with each other? Very nice things. Why are they in the same Mishnah? And secondly, the way that the Mishnah expresses itself is difficult. The first two, the verb comes first. Yehi mamon chavercha. May it be that somebody else's money be like as precious to you as your own. V'heve shakud, and be diligent. What should the parallel be of the third? The yi you call masecha l'shem shemayim, and all of your deeds should be l'shem shemayim. But it doesn't say that. It says v'chol masecha yi l'shem shemayim. Here the verb comes after. Why doesn't the verb precede in the third one too? I think what it means is the following: if you have the right perspective on material possessions, then it's not your money that's important; it's money that's important. You know, Esav said, I have more money than I need. He'd like more, but I have more than I need. And Yaakov said, I have just what I need. But Moshe Feinstein asked, Yaakov is a rich man. He didn't have more than he needed. He wouldn't have been satisfied with less. He had just exactly what he needed. He was a millionaire. He wouldn't have been happy being only a half a millionaire. So why didn't Yaakov say, I have so much more than I need? I can be satisfied with almost nothing. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, by a tzaddik, there is no such thing as more than you need. Because a tzaddik understands that every physical thing in this world was created as a tool to serve God. And God gives you what you need to serve Him. The tools you need to create your world to come. Everybody has their own world to come. Everybody has a different part in the play. And according to